Welcome to Healthcare by the Numbers, a podcast that uncovers what's driving healthcare transformation. Join us each episode as Caravan Health leaders interview the brightest minds inspiring healthcare innovation and discuss the numbers which have shaped their thinking. Hi, everyone. I'm Todd Searles, Vice President of Business Development for Caravan Health and your host of our debut episode, Healthcare by the Numbers. Thank you for listening today. To learn more about Caravan Health, this podcast, and to check out episodes of the show, visit us at caravanhealth.com. And be sure to sign up for our newsletter to get notified of all of our future episodes. You can also visit our program page on Healthcare Now Radio and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook under our username at Caravan Health. At Caravan Health, we know the numbers matter, especially in value-based care. And so I can think of no better person to kick off our inaugural Healthcare by the Numbers podcast than Lynn Barr, our founder and executive chair of Caravan Health. Welcome to the podcast, Lynn.
Oh, thanks, Todd. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Now, I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be very familiar with you, but there could be some who aren't, and especially all of the tireless work that you've done around accountable care. So I'm going to take a minute to introduce you and really focus on some of the impressive numbers that you and Caravan have generated across the industry. For those that aren't familiar with Lynn and her background, Lynn is an absolutely passionate advocate for improving care and protecting our most vulnerable safety net hospitals. She's a driven, successful entrepreneur and a leader in the value-based care and practice transformation arenas. I think Lynn was one of the very first to set up and step up and lead an accountable care organization in rural America when she established the National Rural Accountable Care Organization in 2014. And it was through this work that Lynn realized something that she calls the tyranny of small numbers, which to put it simply means that small ACOs just don't have the size to achieve sustainable success. In practice, what does that mean? Some of the rural facilities she worked with as part of that first rural ACO had financial losses, while others had savings of up to 10%. Without objectively doing anything different than their peers. So the numbers weren't making sense, but I think it's safe to say, Lynn, you and your teams worked to figure it out. I think through all the research you did, the data modeling, the boots on the ground experience, I think you realized which numbers matter in value-based care and which really didn't need to be focused on. And so in 2018, Lynn announced Caravan's first large collaborative ACO, where hospitals and health systems across the country could join together to form an accountable care organization with over 100,000 lives, which would start in 2019. And in fact, that large collaborative grew to more than 230,000 lives and earned shared savings of $33 million in its first year. And then some other impressive numbers through Lynn's leadership, Caravan Health sponsored 21 of the 41 small rural ACOs in the ACO investment model known as AIM. AIM saved Medicare $382 million over 3 years. And by sponsoring 50% of the lives in AIM, Caravan's ACOs have been credited with generating 60% of the savings that CMS earned. Outside of AIM, equally impressive results. In 2019, 15 of the 22 Caravan ACOs saved a total of $154 million. And 7 ACOs are in shared savings totaling $50 million. And those numbers are pretty impressive. And with that, that's where we'd like to start today, Lynn. Congratulations. That is really a testament to what you've worked hard to do since 2014. And I was wondering, can you take us back to that time, 2014, and what, when you first jumped into this space and you realized the opportunity that was before these rural facilities, what were you thinking at the time? And frankly, did you think this is where you would end up?
Oh, thanks, Todd. I think I thought the same thing we all thought was, how hard could this be, right? was the first thing I got wrong, because it was really hard. But it's so funny because, our experience in managed care as a nation really only began in the 80s. In the 90s, right? We dabbled with capitation, and we implemented DRGs in our hospitals, so diagnosis related groups, so that they got paid by the disease and not by the number of days or number of costs. And so in, you know, the early days of managed care, there were a couple of things that everybody, you know, kind of glommed onto. One of the truisms of managed care was, you know, if you just paid attention, you could reduce costs by 20%. So one of the things we went into this thinking is like, wow, there's a lot of money on the table, and we need to get in there and get part of that to, you know, to bring that money back to our health system. The other thing that we thought was that, you know, hospitals were the problem. And here, you know, rural America, rural healthcare is generally hospitals and doctors working together in a community. And there aren't a bunch of people, you know, it's not a bunch of competing health systems and not a lot of independence. And so trying to think about how do you go into this and not put the hospital out of business, right? Mm-hmm. Because if the hospital isn't there, then there's no one to really pull the whole infrastructure together in a rural community. And it's typically the number one employer. So hospitals are critically important. And that was, you know, one of the things we really struggled with early on. And it never occurred to us that the, you know, your ability to actually, you know, lower admission rates is no longer the opportunity that existed in the 80s with before DRGs, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. now because of, you know, so hospitals have already learned how to get patients out of the hospital as quickly as possible. They're not just like, oh, come on, let's bring you in and we'll just keep you there until the payer quits, you know? So this isn't how we operate. So it was very, you know, it wasn't, everything we thought was true going in ended up to be wrong. You know, if we really, really worked hard at this, we can reduce the cost of care by 1% or 2%, maybe 3% or 4% per year, which is a lot, right? I mean, if we did that as a nation, we could reduce the, you know, the burden on our children by tens of trillions of dollars. So that's work worth doing, but it isn't the kind of big bang work that we saw in the 80s. Yeah. It's that incremental hard work of helping one patient at a time.
So when the turtle versus the hare, right? I think going into it, there was probably the hare moment and, you know, hey, we could do this and we're going to achieve these great results. When did you, I mean, like when, how many years in were you when you realized that it would, to do this right, it's going to be slow, steady, constant improvement that's going to win the day?
You could see that right away because the traditional tools of managed care, like utilization review, mm-hmm. I mean, that, are you kidding me? I mean, it's a joke. I mean, there's, you know, you can't do utilization review when patients have unending choice. It's not a capitated model. And, you know, the problem generally isn't that that people are ordering too much stuff. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the patients aren't taking care of themselves. And that's not the patient's problem. That's the healthcare system's problem because we don't give them the tools to take care of themselves. You know, they walk out of the meeting with their physicians and they remember half of it and it's complicated and it's really hard to get appointments. And, you know, they're all just sort of out there trying to help themselves. So when we looked at, you know, the opportunity, some people think the opportunity is to try to, you know, fix bad spending in the system. And we couldn't find really hardly any of that. We saw a little bit of fraud. Very little in our data. And I looked at utilization data till my eyes bled and you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell the difference between high utilizers and low utilizers because, you know, the patients are so different and the data is so noisy. Yeah. So, you know, what could you do? You could help patients. You could one-on-one get nurses in the practices to support the physicians and start supporting patients and helping them manage their disease. And that's really hard, not terribly sexy, but incredibly rewarding work.
Yeah.
But it is nothing like the managed care of the 80s.
Well, and I'm kind of curious. I mean, most people would look at that rural space, you know, razor thin margins, and say, I'm probably not going to start a business, you know, catering to this space. And yet you did, and you've become a successful entrepreneur in that space with this messaging, right? It's all about physician-patient interaction. It's about providing those tools to the patient. I mean, is this an internal, you know, decision that this is your life's mission in this space? Or, I mean, what led you to jump in where others fear to go?
It's a good question. As you mentioned, I've been a serial entrepreneur, and this is my fifth startup. And so one of the kind of basics of startups is try to go someplace where no one else is going, yeah. Right? Yep. Well, rural America.
Rural healthcare. You got it.
People were not jumping into that space other than, you know, some unfortunate, you know, people that are trying to, you know, make money on the fringes. Mm-hmm. But so there wasn't a lot of people in the value-based space. But the other part of it was I fell in love with the rural providers. When I was getting my master's in public health at the University of California, what I'd done was I'd done a bunch of device and diagnostics and pharmaceutical type of enterprises in the past. And I wanted to go work on value-based care. I wanted to try to make a difference. I felt like I'd spent my entire career like building stuff that we could sell, you know, that we do to patients, you know, and you know, remember the Hippocratic Oath, first right. Do no harm. And I couldn't tell really whether I was helping people or not. You know, the clinical trials were, you know, ivory tower, and right. You know, we you know, nobody used anything on label. Mm-hmm. And so my part of why I turned to this whole world of value-based care and helping the healthcare system was just having spent my career working in healthcare systems across the world and in the United States, and just seeing a very broken system. So I went and I got my master's in public health at the University of California. And what I was thinking about at the time was to get at real data about patients, because like I say, I'd taken 13 products through the FDA and worldwide markets, and I couldn't really tell you whether they worked or not, or how they worked, or what really happened once they left the manufacturing floor, mm-hmm. because there's so much done and their patients are so variable. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we had a Google of healthcare information where we could all, you know, just sit down in front of it and say, okay, I've got diabetes, I'm 62 years old, I'm hypertensive, and I've just been told I have lymphoma. Mm. What's going to happen to me? Yep. Right? Yep. What happens to patients like me? Because that information is not readily available, and we rely on peer-reviewed journals. But I know from my experience that peer-reviewed journals only reflect the studies we did, and the studies we did didn't tell the true story, yeah. Right? Because yeah. you'd never get anything through clinical trial if it did, yep. Right? So I thought, well, let's see if we could start working on getting data. So I went back to school, and my first semester, the High Tech Act passed. So I was thinking, I'm just going to go out and try to convince people to get electronic medical records like you did,
Todd. Right. Exactly. Right? Yeah.
I thought, like, okay, that'll take the rest of my life.
Right.
And boom, first semester, it's over. It's done. You know, everybody's going to get electronic medical records. Yep. I'm like, okay, now what do I do? So I thought, for the first time, it's really possible. And so I got very excited about health information exchange and how do I get all the data in one place so we can start, you know, really learning about what, you know, what healthcare does, you know. Yeah. So I did my internship. I led the consulting team that wrote the strategic plan for the state of California on health information technology and exchange. And that was an eye-opener. We convened 600 stakeholders across the state. And, you know, California, everybody thinks of California as, you know, Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Right.
But California has 65 rural hospitals. 95% of the state is rural. I live in rural California, and you know, it's beautiful, and it's got, you know, critical access hospitals just like Iowa, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, people that look a lot like the folks do in Iowa, you know, it's just, it's rural America, right here in California. Well, so convening my 600 stakeholders in their various groups and learning about, you know, what do they want? What do they need out of health information exchange? What I learned was that basically none of the physician groups or hospitals, chains, for-profits, nonprofits, no one really wanted to exchange data. Yeah. The conviction was that was their data. It was proprietary. It gave them a competitive advantage, and they didn't want anybody else to see it. So they would allow us to send it, but they wouldn't allow us to store it.
Right.
So, right. Which, so is the basically the same thing as saying you can't have it.
Right.
Right. And that's where we still are today. Yeah. Well, guess who wanted, who was happy to share their data? The rural providers.
Yep.
Every single one of them. They were like, yeah, of course you're going to have my data. Now, why is it that HIE has been more successful in Oklahoma and Nebraska than it has in California and New York?
Yep.
Maybe it's because the providers think it's a good idea.
Yep.
So given that they were willing to share their data, and that there was this huge unmet need, because nobody was really working with the rural providers. Matter of fact, up to the point I stepped in at a rural hospital and started building this program, there had been 26 different initiatives that had come through in innovation and CMS demonstration projects. And rural, the only one they were able to participate was, I don't know, some frontier program that never, you know, it was nothing. It was sort of like, here, we'll give you some money and you're on the frontier, you know.
Right.
But obviously never became, you know, a permanent program. So that's how I ended up with rural. And they ended up with me was you know, there was a desire to actually, you know, get data, exchange data. They didn't have access to data. And I thought, well, at least, you know, there's 60 million people living in rural America. Yep. That's the size of a good sized European country. If I had their data, we could build that database and maybe we could figure out, you know, which drugs our patients should be taking and which ones they shouldn't.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. I mean, I came to rural market after working at some of the largest health systems, and you're absolutely right. I think most people discount the drive, the desire. I did. As I used to say, I was an urban snob, right? When it came to healthcare and the needs and the wants and even the technology that was being used in the rural space, they don't have the resources. So they invest when they can in good technology to make this information exchange happen. And it really should have come as no surprise then when AIM was released, it was something that you lobbied for, that look, there are these people out here in rural America who are trying desperately to modernize their systems, get up to speed, you know, involve themselves in HIEs, involve themselves in better care for their patients, better communication with their patients, families, things like that. So AIM appeared, the investment model for these rural critical access hospitals. What do you think was the biggest selling point for moving that program forward with this group that you had created a relationship with, knew that there was an interest there, but to get them into a value-based contract, what did AIM provide that nothing else up to that point had done?
Well, that's a good question. I will never forget the recruiting period for the ACO investment model. We'd started in, I mean, we knew it was coming because we had talked to CMS about it. So we got a pretty early start. We started about March or April. Mm-hmm. And I swear to God, I must have driven to 50 different rural hospitals to talk to their boards over that 4-month period. It was pretty crazy. We would
intense.
Do like 5 to 10 webinars a day.
It was nuts. Well, there are 300 critical access hospitals out there, right? So most people don't realize that. Yeah.
You know, and so they were all afraid they were going to put themselves out of business. That was the only thing that got in their way, right? And, you know, because that's what happened in the 80s, and that's what they'd been told, and that's what everybody believed, you know, so that was not naive on their part. But why did they do it? They did it because they were afraid of being left behind. And that if they didn't do it, they didn't know what was going to happen. And that was the same reason I started it. Right. Yeah. It was, you know, I mean, it was, I was attracted about the data, you know, it's like, wow, here's a good way to get really clean data, you know, claims data. That was exciting. But, you know, as I was working in a rural hospital, I'm like, so the whole world is changing and we're not. And the last time that happened, hundreds and hundreds of hospitals closed. And that's when they introduced DRGs, right? And they introduced DRGs based on a pilot in New Jersey, a one-year pilot in New Jersey, said, this is great. We'll pay everybody this way. And not thinking how that was going to affect rural hospitals. And it took them, I believe it was 4 years to come out with the critical access hospital rule. Wow. And they just watched themselves die. And so, you know, these guys have been around this block before. So there is a real desire, you know, to stay with the healthcare system and to be a part of it. But there are challenges of, you know, high fixed costs, low numbers, I mean, are really, really difficult to deal with. So I admire their foresight and their guts. And I think that what we've seen is it's made them very successful as health systems for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah. I mean, that was the foundation for many of them to not only dip their toe, but really to jump in with both feet. And now we have an opportunity with the new chart model that's coming out, something we internally like to call AIM 2.0, you know, in terms of moving forward, unofficial, you know, trademark, you know, sort of thing. But in terms of the future, do you still see these groups who have yet to move forward? Do you think they would move forward this time?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, there's, you know, there's a great book out there called Crossing the Chasm, and it talks about, you know, the first movers and then the second wave. And the first movers are in, and the second wave, this will bring the second wave in. So I think that a lot of people have been hoping there'd be another opportunity. You know, last time AIM came out, was 2016, right? And here we are, we're now looking at the next time it came out in 2022, right? So this is, you know, okay, it was 6 years on a three-year model, right? To a three-year model, it's 6 years to get it back out the door, even though it was the most successful program CMMI or CMS has ever had, number one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's going to be another 5 or 6 years before it happens again. And it's, you know, it's a great opportunity for health systems that don't have the capital to be able to get into the game so that they can start generating the capital and they can stay in the game and they can stay current. And I think with the amount of funding they give and the amount of time in the program with the right support, this can be a long-term sustainable program that's built on a small investment from the federal government.
So with that investment, do you think with COVID, which we would be remiss, just like every podcast, every, you know, social media site, every hospital executive who's thinking about COVID, and, you know, there is the patient care aspect of it, there's the physician and care team burnouts, but there's really the revenue component. And a lot of elective surgeries have been canceled. You know, they're going to be a struggle for some of these small rural facilities to eke back to a sense of normalcy, both in terms of how they operate, but also through capturing revenue. I know Caravan has been at the forefront in terms of helping our communities with virtual visits, But do you see AIM 2.0 or the CHART ACO program, the transfer or the ACO transformation track? Do you see them, these facilities looking to that as a way to bridge what has been just a horrible, horrible year for revenue into normalcy?
Well, you know, I mean, the effects of the pandemic, you know, are still going to be what they are, right? And, mm-hmm. and remember that if utilization goes down across the country, the benchmark goes down across the country. So it's not like people got paid for the utilization they didn't get in an ACO type model. If it was capitation, they would, right? But that's a much higher risk model. So, you know, if volumes continue to go down, if volumes go down like they did with the pandemic, you know, it's going to have to be the government coming in again and helping providers, because our system wasn't built that way. We're built on fee for service. So it's going to be challenging. Now, like, getting back to the revenue question, though, is the more of your revenue that is tied to population health, whether that's population health services, telehealth, E&Ms, chronic care management, remote patient monitoring, all of those things can continue to go on in a pandemic. And they are good revenue streams. They're good, solid revenue streams. Value-based payments are good, can become good, solid revenue streams if you have enough lives, which is why we put so many together. Mm-hmm. So there's ways to get more revenue. But the effect of the pandemic on all this is, like I say, if everyone's volumes went down, then, you know, they didn't give half to everyone. Right. I kind of wish they had, but they didn't. However, if, you know, if we look at 2021 as probably going to be a rebound year in terms of cost, right? So patients delayed care, vaccines coming, you expect the second half of 21 to have pretty high utilization compared to other years. Just remember, 60% of your benchmark will be based on 2021. So you probably couldn't have a better year for a benchmark.
Yeah.
And then going into 2022, but you know, if there is another pandemic, we won't be able to recover, you know, everything we lost.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is. And it is truly unfortunate. I think all of us have our fingers crossed that the vaccine will return to normalcy. I know that, you know, my own parents included, right? They're looking at the end of next year to do those hip surgeries, right? That everybody put off this year. So
right. it's going to be packed.
Right. Yeah. It could be a bumper year, as it were, for orthopedic surgeons and everything. But it's a crazy time that we live in. I think as we look towards the future, you know, we focus on revenue. We focus on, you know, how many hospitals could potentially close out of the pandemic. What are the things that you're focused on moving forward?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's a really good question, because the pandemic has changed how we look at so many things. You know, fee for service doesn't work if there's no service. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I hope that there's more of an approach to normalcy in terms of how we pay for healthcare, you know, particularly around the areas of, you know, safety net hospitals and primary care. I mean, I think that at Caravan, we've got to do everything we can to financially support our hospitals. You know, we're looking at recently how the ACO data can help them capture 340B claims they may not be seeing because they're not in their EMR, but they're caring for that patient. It's attributed patients. So, you know, we've got to continue to look for ways for them to get the right kind of revenue, right? Not, you know, not the wrong kind of revenue, not like, let's set up a, you know, a new service with questionable value because it makes a lot of money, but let's set up these services that really bring our patients closer to us and help them manage their disease and manage their care. I'm looking forward to a kind of a quieter time. You know, more patients moving into Medicare Advantage. There's certainly a lot more interest from the other payers about value-based care in 21 than I've seen in a long time. So maybe finally it'll become more, you know, more of the payers will come in. It'll become more of a rational program. I just hope, you know, my personal dream about where this could and should go next is a single claim-based system for the entire country. I don't see why we have to submit claims all over the place. You know, my last hospital had 25 beds and it had 50 billers and coders.
Wow.
Right? That's crazy. You know, we should be, you know, the administrative cost of just submitting claims and you know, the lack of data we have is killing us. And we could reduce the cost of care 10 to 20% if we just got rid of that. So I'm advocating for a single system where we can all submit all of our claims. Every payer can have their own rules. Every payer can pay a different price. But do we have to submit to every one of them? You know, I mean, who came up with that idea? So
yeah.
That's what I hope the future holds.
Well, a bunch of interface analysts who like point-to-point connections, I think.
Job security. That's right. All the time.
That's right. They get a per interface fee and they're happy about it, right? So, which circles back to your HIE comments, right? What was the biggest hurdle that a lot of places had were $40,000 interface fees to their EHR company, right? And who's going to pay that in the rural space? And HIEs, I think, at one point stood up and said, we will, because the data is that important. And
right.
Yeah, but yeah, moving forward, that would be an outstanding idea. So do I see serial entrepreneur number 7?
No. No, you see the beach in my future. No, that's my advocacy point, though. I've been trying to advocate for that, just to simplify things, because then we would have one claim system, and just think how much power we would have if we had all the data on all of our patients. And for me to like be trying, you know, I get a little bit from Medicare and I get a little bit more from that Medicare Advantage plan. Oh, come on, here comes Blue Cross. You know, it's like, it's crazy. You know, if we had one system, then we would have one. We would also have clean data on all of our patients, and we'd have a national health record for everybody in the country.
And the reports that physicians and their care team could get would be instantaneous, and they would cross payers, and they could just worry about caring for the patients in front of them without necessarily worrying about the, you know, where their claims are stuck. That's a beautiful thought. And I hope the advocacy continues from the beach at some point, you know, but I think as you look ahead, any final thoughts, you know, that shaping, you know, the numbers, what, you know, whether or not it's a chief executive, you know, officer for a rural safety net facility or a CMO at a large academic medical center, do you think that there's a number that they are focused on through 2020? Is it the, you know, is it the vaccine date? Is it the, you know, their bottom line? Something that as we look forward to future episodes of Healthcare by the Numbers podcast, we can have you come back and say, remember when I talked about this number? Here's where we are today. What do you think is going to drive us moving forward?
Well, I think the number that we're all focused on right now is the, you know, how many new cases did we get today, right? Yep. And, you know, so we're all following that and waiting for that number to get to a very small number that says we're back to work. You know, this is just about gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's back to normal. And so that'll be the, you know, the number that matters the most when it comes to, you know, numbers around ACOs. And I just can't caution people enough to, you know, if we can't tell if a 10,000 life ACO has savings or losses because the data is so variable, please don't judge, you know, yourself or others by those numbers. You know, they're indicators, but you've got to have better indicators. You know, because those numbers are highly variable and subject to small changes in the population. And that's where we see, you know, the numbers swinging wildly is with changes in the population that you're measuring that look the same, but really aren't. And so I caution anybody using data to judge the performance of any physician or, you know, of any health system. I think the only number you've got to use numbers that you can trust, that are reliable, that are completely objective, and that you can trend over time so you can get to some sort of statistical relevance, because it can be very misleading to look at these numbers, and because we don't have a very good picture, socioeconomic determinants of the patients, mental illness. I mean, there's all kinds of missing pieces that make it very hard for people to interpret based on performance based on data.
Well, and look no further than right, the whole payers, right? They don't have 10,000 life health plans usually. And that's due to the, you know, all of that statistical variation that comes in having such low numbers. So,
you know, who does have 10,000 life health plans?
Who's that?
Well, there's two groups. There's employers.
Right.
So yep. they take risk on small numbers because they reinsure it, and the cost of them, you know, having somebody else take the risk isn't worth it, right? It's like 20% higher, so it's worth it. And then it's provider-based health plans. Yep. You know, they're all like 10,000 lives. And, you know, if you look at the data, they're not doing very well.
Yep.
And so I think that's the other thing. Everybody, when we started this, everybody's like, oh yeah, then we're going to have our own provider-based health plan. And I was drinking the same Kool-Aid everybody else was. So I can't, you know, everything everybody believed, we all believed. And that was one of the things we believed. I had a little staircase that showed, you know, and then we'll be in Medicare Advantage. And now I realize that, you know, I would need tens of thousands of lives to be able to pull that off. And that's out of the reach of almost all provider systems. So there's a few really large organizations that can do their own health plans because they've got the numbers. But by and large, it's really dicey, particularly in the Medicare space.
Well, that's insight through experience. Unless you have tried, you wouldn't necessarily believe that. And
right.
I think through your experience, you've proven what is a feasible way forward, right? It's that 1%, 2% that you can earn year over year. This is sustainable. This is where people should focus, come together, create large collaboratives, and success is, you know, is never guaranteed, but it is by far more sustainable and easier to achieve when the numbers work in your favor as opposed to against you.
That's right. That's right. And that way, you know, you're working, if you're looking at the data in the aggregate, you can say, okay, yes, wellness visits, chronic care management works. Utilization review, not so much, you know, because you can see it in your numbers if you have enough. So that's good advice.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for kicking off our first episode of Healthcare by the Numbers. It's been a true pleasure, not only having you on our first episode, but looking forward to future episodes where we have you back and kind of update us on not only changes in the industry, but also how the numbers are changing to force new plans in this space, especially in that rural, the safety net space, which is near and dear to everyone's heart here at Caravan Health. So thank you again.
Thank you, Todd, and have a good afternoon.
Yeah, and you too. For Thanks. Our audience, if you'd like to learn more about Lynn and hear what she's up to, you can follow her on Twitter at Lynn Barr, NRACO, and on LinkedIn at Lynn Barr, BARR. To learn more about Caravan Health, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Our username is at Caravan Health. You can also sign up for our newsletter at www.caravanhealth.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. I'm Todd Searles for Caravan Health and Healthcare by the Numbers. Until we talk next time.